three versions of the Bible right now that that are in print, and they are the only interpretations that we have. Now, there is no interpretation presently in existence that says Christ didn't suffer.
In Italy, one bishop wanted to talk to me. I greeted him, and by this time I am known around the world to hold the view that, Christ did not suffer. And he, being an authority in his religion, he said, he started just this point. I said, I wouldn't say Christ suffered, nor should anyone suffer. He said, if we take away suffering from the life of Christ, then the whole thing will become a comedy. That means devoid of any substance. Then I said, better his life be a divine comedy than a tragedy. If it has to be something, let it be a divine comedy rather than a tragedy in suffering. And then I said, it does not befit the followers of Christ to say that their leader was so incapable that he fell into suffering.
Yes.
Now, what happened was, when he was called on the cross, fine, in that garden or whatever you say, that was the time when he was called off. And he started to review his work in the world, if he was the Son of God. He was sent to take away suffering from human society. Fine. Then when he was called back, he started to review. And then he exclaimed, or what you said, take off this cup from me, means I was given the job to do. My mission in the world was to free the men from suffering. That, I see, is not complete. I have not yet been able to complete my job, and then why are you calling me back? Why are you taking my cup away? The job that I was given is incomplete. I am being called back. There is some other saying, what is that? Thou hast forsaken me, or some such thing. Why hast thou forsaken me? That means, why? He couldn't find any reason, because he knew he didn't commit any mistake. So he couldn't find out why he was called back. And then he said, why hast thou forsaken me? That means, why have you taken me away from the duty I was assigned? And if it is so, fine, let thy will be done. Because you sent me, you are calling me, you are the best judge of the situation, now I don't bother, let thy will be done. You are calling me, I am coming up. Where is the sense of suffering in this case? And if Christ suffered, that means he was not able to take the will of God in delight. And that means he was not a proper instrument in the hand of the divine. And therefore, it is very humiliating for Christ that the exponents of his divinity should proclaim him to be suffering. But as I said, there has always been this tragedy of knowledge. The speaker speaks from his level, the listener listens from his level, and there is this gap. Christ spoke from his level. The people suffering people heard those words and meant them to be on the level of suffering because their consciousness was suffering. A suffering man can only interpret the words in the light of suffering. And that is how the whole story of Christ has been mutilated and pulled down to a very dilapidated state of suffering. Christ doesn't deserve to be called someone who suffered. Someone who is in communion with God. How can he suffer? And if Christ, having been in communion of God, could suffer, what is the value of such a communion with God who cannot even save a man from suffering? What is the value of God realization? The whole religious concept of faith becomes completely useless the moment we put suffering on Christ. No logic can possibly save this tragedy. The whole thing is basically wrong. And such wrong interpretations of the original scriptures are responsible for continued suffering of mankind, generation after generation. And
Christ didn't suffer. He did not undergo any suffering. Then why did he express disappointment, for instance, when his disciples were watching with him in the Garden of Eden when he was undergoing his passion or whatever it may have been now? He said to them when he came out, "Could you not watch with me 1 hour?" Now,
could you not
watch with me 1 hour?
Yes.
Because they had fallen asleep on the outside. Now, there are many instances such as this which happened in his life in which he is recorded to have expressed disappointment.
Then either we reject him as no good, full of disappointment and suffering, or try to interpret his words in such a way that we can hold him high. There is no other middle path. If we want to hold that he suffered and he was full of the disappointments here and there and there and there, either we should interpret differently or hold on that he was no good. And because we don't want to hold that he was no good, we interpret such expressions differently. Otherwise, what else can we do? Can you suggest anything? The thing is, my objection is that if we hold him to be suffering, then we put him in a very weak position. Devotion is no good on the platform of guilt. On the platform of love, happiness, devotion is significant. On the level of guilt, the devotion can only make a man continuously suffer.
Maharishi? May I speak about this? I was brought up by a very religious mother, and we heard about Christ every day. And I never heard a word about suffering until I came to SRM, hardly. I was brought up on the message of love. And I really hardly heard, we knew about Christ on the cross, but I thought, well, I mean, surely he could have managed that being a god. That was nothing to him. I never heard about suffering. I really didn't. And she was the most religious woman I've ever met.
That is a right religious teaching.
I agree with Maharishi 100%.
Mike, yes.
Maharishi, I'd just like to point something out as a historian. I belong to the Eastern branch of Christianity, and we have emphasized not the Garden of Gethsemane, not Good Friday, though we realized that was necessary in a world where mortal men were involved in suffering, but that the true meaning in life of Christ is found on Easter morning, the resurrection, the rebirth of life, the victory over suffering and over death. In other words, creation is emphasized and not destruction.
In that way, we save our sentiments for him.
One reads the early records of Christianity, the early days in the Roman Empire, when the first Christians worshipped this new faith. It was not yet known as Christianity. It was known as the Evangel, Evangelion, which is a Greek word and means the glad tidings. The glad tidings, the tidings of hope, the tidings of salvation, the tidings of happiness. And the early Christians were the downtrodden, the suffering, the slaves, the people who were serving the masters in the Roman Empire. They met in the catacombs underground in order to follow their new faith, the faith of happiness and bliss consciousness. And this impression is a very vivid one when one visits the catacombs where these early Christians 2,000 years ago worshipped. And anybody who has gone to the catacombs I think, will agree with me. Now, we are now 2,000 years after the birth of Christ. Much has been added. Much has been translated and retranslated. Many dogmas have been added to the faith of Christianity.
We are free to give our interpretation to Christ or Buddha or Krishna or Shankara or Muhammad or any. And we do it for the love of them all. When we say we don't think Christ suffered, then we say so out of our sentiment of holding him high, and that is our thinking. If it differs from the standard understanding about the life of Christ, we can't impose our understanding on those who are the custodians of his teaching. We can only sympathize with them and say, let his will be done. That's all. From the platform of spiritual regeneration movement or IMS or SIMS, we don't speak of faith, religious belief. But when we are asked, in all sincerity we say, we hold him high and we think he did not suffer. And suffering was levied on to him from the level of the suffering man who saw him on the cross, who saw blood coming out of his hand, and who saw this and who saw this. So, from his level of understanding, man could only have interpreted that state of Christ in suffering. But if those who listen to us believe that Christ suffered, we could say he might have suffered, doesn't matter. Whether he suffered or not, we are no judge to declare. We are prepared to take the view that is given to us by the custodians of his teachings, by the Church of Christ, and what we want is whether the people believe in the suffering or believing they don't want to suffer or not believing they don't want to suffer. What we advise them is meditate and be happy. Or if those who say, no, we must have to suffer, fine, meditate and continue to suffer as long as suffering is possible. We have no objection if someone tries to hang on to suffering, but we say, come on, keep on suffering, start meditation. Just as a man has not to believe on anything in order to meditate, so he does not have to believe in happiness in life in order to meditate. He doesn't have to believe in happiness, he doesn't have to believe in peace, he doesn't have to believe in anything whatsoever let him meditate and then take care of himself. Our purpose is to teach meditation. We don't want to change any understanding about life or any faith of man or anything. That is not our purpose. Our purpose is to give meditation, a simple natural process. Meditate and then you will come out of relaxation and this and this and this. On the level of present need of man, we want to give him meditation. We don't talk of big, high philosophies and all that. Here, with me, you are discussing so many things, but not all those things are to be said out in public. In the Western world, or even in the Eastern world, the faith, different kinds of faith, different kinds of living, different kinds of understanding, and we don't indulge ourselves in either of them, nothing. It's a meditation, simple, natural technique, meditation, that's all. No religious faith, no religious discussions, nothing, because we don't expound religion, we don't expound philosophies. We expound a simple technique, very simple, natural, which we have experienced in life and have felt that it does good in our daily routine. One becomes better. That's all. More than that, we just don't talk. It's a waste of our time. Here, sometimes we may even undesiringly may enter into that area or that area, but all that is not our field. Our field is purely transcendental meditation, subtlest relative, transcendent, and then the absolute coming into the relative, and just that. Not deviate here and there and there and there. Sometimes I take you off the track just for the sake of some amusement, recreation, some change of thought here and there. Otherwise, that is not at all our channel. We don't talk of karma and don't talk of three gunas and don't talk of all such things. Don't talk of reincarnation. No. All these things, we don't talk of spiritism and all, we don't have much time to think about it. But when I find you are bored with hearing absolute and relative and for a change sometimes I dwell on these. Otherwise, all that is not our field. A simple, natural practice, meditation, just like that.
I'd like to ask a question that I promised not to talk about.
1500 years would be hearing.
But I've had this question in my mind for about a
year, so I thought I'd better ask it so it won't be any means for stress or anything. to satisfy my intellect and my heart, I'd like to know if there is any difference at all in any way in the state which remains after losing the body in either of the three, if one could say three states, after realization, cosmic consciousness, guide consciousness, and Brahman consciousness. If there isn't, why? And if there is, why? Thank you.
After leaving the body?
After leaving the body, yes.
Or while leaving the body?
After. While I know there would be a difference in perception of leaving the body.
Because of the different ranges of relative life.
Yes, but I haven't had it clear yet whether there would be a difference after leaving the body.
After leaving the body, what happens is individuality drops off. Otherwise, no difference. Because in cosmic consciousness, one lives that unbounded awareness. God consciousness also one lives that unbounded awareness. In supreme knowledge also one lives that unbounded awareness. The difference that takes place is in the relative life. In cosmic consciousness is gross experience. In the God consciousness is celestial experience. In unity of life, unity dominates.
One of the reasons
pure consciousness dominates. That means when there are gradations in the relative aspect of life. There is no gradation in the absolute. And therefore, when the relative drops, all the means of different grades drops off. And one just that pure awareness, absolute remains absolute.
I can understand this, but the reason why I'm asking this question now is that I remember that you said that when a man in God consciousness goes to sleep, the difference in his sleep and a man in cosmic consciousness would be that the divine light would shine in addition to the awareness of the transcendent. And, I didn't understand it correctly then.
In sleep, what happens? The field of relative experience drops off. What remains? Pure consciousness. Now, whether the field of relative existence is gross awareness of the crude waking state or subtle awareness of the most refined waking state, waking state drops off. So the celestial experience of waking state also drops off, and the in cosmic consciousness is gross also drops off. What remains is pure awareness.
Your answer makes me very happy. Because I was wondering why you emphasize the importance of getting God consciousness before losing the body, and if the emphasis is in living, then I can understand that very well, and I'm happy with that.
The difference is only while living, only while living, in the waking state.
Thank you.